Blog Talk Radio.
Comes the time because we're alive, because we want to stay alive. In Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You're now tuned into the inner higher frequency. Soul class number 367, independence declaring itself as what? Now that we're broadcasting live today on this celebrated day here on Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, unifying souls, actually, July 4th, 2014. Program content will be focused on reading from the Declaration of Independence with potent commentary provided us by reading from Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances written by Alan W. Cecil. And while others may use this special day to cook hamburgers, hot dogs, watch baseball games, go to the beach and observe fireworks explode in the sky, we thought it would be important to review as much as possible this important document in human history, which is not of prophetic significance, but could ultimately inspire the entire human family experience to actually learn and fulfill what is of prophetic experience, namely the eternal seven universal Noahide commandments. Our call in number is 1-347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Almighty Creator bless you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly as well. We humbly advise any blessed soul to receive more blessings by purchasing Alan W. Cecil's book, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. Just Google it up. You can get it on Amazon.com. And we're going to turn down the music and ask forgiveness from Rev. Isaac Baton, blessed prayer brother and spirit soul, and chanting out not just at the famous Frankel Show, but also at Beit Mazal, where he is the president. And they hold weekly Shabbos, Sabbath prayer, chanting ceremony, services, I should say, singing the best of Jewish, Sephardic, North African music, and combining it with the Psalms of King David and the other prophets of Israel. We'll just turn down the music. And again, Beit Mazal is located at 1433 President Street, located between Kingston Avenue and Albany Avenue, Kingston Avenue and Albany Avenue in Kessicron Heights. Well, we'll just let the music play out. Here it comes. And before we bring on our blessed co-host today, blessed souls, I just want to mention as a caveat, we the Jewish people are in fact indebted to some of us to a small extent, some of us to a great extent, the fact that there is a United States of America. And perhaps some of the commentary today might seem a little critical and probably in some people's eyes overly critical, but let's remember one thing. Since the chet of the Eitz Hadas, since the sin of the tree of good and evil, you can't have good without a little bit of evil, and you can't have evil with a little bit without a little bit of good. And I just want to give you an understanding how we Jewish people look as we live in countries outside of our native land, the land of Israel. And it's brought down to a very succinct point in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 9, verses 4 through 7, which I'm going to read right now. And this is the spirit which I plan to be operating on. And I believe I'm also speaking on behalf of my co-hosts as well for what we are aiming for in today's program, although it might be a little polemic for some people's minds. So chapter 29, verse 4 in Jeremiah reads, "Thus says Hashem, Master of Legions, God of Israel, to all of the exile who I am exiled from Jerusalem to Babylonia, i.e. now America, build houses and settle, plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives and beget sons and daughters, take wives for your sons and give your daughters to men and let them give birth to sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not let your numbers diminish. Seek the peace of the city to which I have exiled you, and pray to it to Creator, for through its peace will you have peace." So therefore, blessed souls, on this day of independence, we are praying for the peace, the ultimate peace of America, and for all the nations of the world for that matter, to be able to be masig, to reach and comprehend that peace which should be accessible openly to all human beings as part of the human family experience, all the families of nations. To learn more about that, go to chapter 12, verse 3 in Genesis. But I've spoken my piece. Now I want to bring in my most worthy, and I'm very always humbled by their presence, co-hosting with me. We have today Rambam, activist, teacher, student disseminator of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Dennis Ryan, and also we have the author of Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, Alan Cecil. Good morning, Dennis, and good morning, Alan. And good morning, Dennis.
Oh, good
morning. Excuse me.
Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, with that being said, let's go right into the program, gentlemen. And this is a free-falling dialogue. We have another hour and 53 minutes. I do wish to incorporate two more songs to segue because it is a long program today. The appendix, which starts off in page 467 from Alan W. Cecil's book, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, reads as follows, and then we'll turn to both Dennis and Alan for feedback. "There are many people who enjoin us to become active citizens once again to try to fix our broken legal system." And Mr. Cecil was quoting from Derber's Corporation Nation, chapter pages 9 through 10, "Our nation is in need of a transformation movement, one that combines the forces of a healthy business, energized workers and unions, and newly activist citizens. And yet it does not seem to occur to them that it is the legal system itself that is the problem and that it needs to be replaced. There has been little, if any, criticism of the Constitution itself, and brought down by William, and Mr. Cecil brings down by William N. Eskridge, Constitutional Stupidities, Constitutional Tragedies, which was published by New York University Press in 1998, that academics endlessly debate issues of constitutional interpretation and almost never talk about the flaws inherent in the document itself. So most criticism has to do with dependent variables dealing with social and economic factors. You can criticize big government, you can criticize crooked politicians, but to criticize the Constitution is to most people treasonous." And this is brought down, he also brings down, Alan does, from Eidelberg's Beyond the Secular Mind, "Since all new states originate by force, say rather in revolutionary violence, their founders are and by definition must be criminals. Only after they have established new orders do they become legitimate and respectable. Yet we should ask ourselves, what is treason before we start casting such fire brands at each other? The Torah's definition of treason is going against God's Torah. However, in Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution, it states, quote, "Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, when hearing to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort," end of quote. And when people get all bent out of shape when someone criticizes the, quote-unquote, the holy and, quote-unquote, sacred Constitution, they forget that the Constitution itself was written by men themselves guilty of high treason, and these men had produced a document that had become the benchmark apology for treason, a classic document which enumerated the reasons for freeing a society from a crooked and unjust government, at that time being the England, English government, And that document is called the Declaration of Independence. So I realize we're going to need a lot of flexibility for this program, Blessed Souls, and I'm going to ask you to please give your ears and your minds and your hearts the proper focus to listen now into the feedback, first by Dennis and followed up by Alan. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, these matters are that people came over to this country originally mainly based on religious freedom. All the original colonies were set up on a religious basis, including Maryland, which was for the Catholics, and it was dubbed that name because that was the mother of Jesus of Nazareth, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
The only other colony that wasn't there for religious purposes was Georgia, and that was for indentured servants. Other than that, all these people came from different religions and different sects, especially in New England. They separated because they were in different sects. So they really took religion at heart and in their minds. And what did they proceed to do? They stamped "In God We Trust" on everything. Now, what country has ever done that before? Now, these people who came here were not lawyers. They weren't well-educated people. Most of them were oriented to farmers, but they were looking for freedom. And believe it or not, it wasn't until the Supreme Court this past week actually came out and said that the freedom of religion is very, very important. And no matter what the government does or the Justice Department does, the freedom of religion will stand. So we are finally recognizing a principle that was embedded in all our original documents when the country was founded. I thought it was refreshing. I can understand the author, Alan, saying that what happened to all this wonderful stuff that we began with? Have we lost it? Are we adrift in the water? We are, but thank goodness man has a way of coming back for retribution, forgiveness, and saying, maybe we did something wrong. Let's correct it.
Beautiful, Dennis. And I just, before Alan chimes in, I just want to mention the fact that Alan mentions that a document that's become a benchmark apology for treason, and those people who were involved in the Declaration of Independence were treasonous to the government that formally have sovereignty on them until the Revolutionary War and the winning of the war by the colonies. Even in Jewish history, I mean, Moses was deemed treasonous by the Egyptian government after he killed the Egyptian who was beating almost to death an Israelite in Egypt, and he ran from his life. So you can just imagine that when Moses came back, the defiant Paro looked at him, because he knew of Moses, that here was a treasonous Egyptian. In fact, he was raised in Paro's house. So this is not really a precedent, what took place in the American colonies, of rebelling against the government. Even in Israelite history had that. In fact, King David was sought after for treason, and King Saul wanted to kill him, even though it was really more the product of King Saul's spiritual sickness after his kingdom had been torn from him, as prophesied to him by Samuel the prophet, Shmuel the Navi. So it's not a precedent that such a document should be produced, because for us of Israel, our ultimate declaration of independence is what we call the Ten Commandments, and what constitutes the Constitution that follows is the rest of the 603 or the 613 commandments with the oral and Torah traditions, oral and written traditions. So this, I think, the fact that this took place in another country at a time where monarchies were ruthlessly running the world from England and other parts of Western Europe gives it its benchmark in history. However, the American experience, let's remember, is only about 238 years old from the signing of the Declaration of Independence today, from 1776. And it takes a long time for a nation really to settle in and congeal to be what it's supposed to be ultimately as an actualized civilization. So America is really still in the beginning parts. I mean, they've grown as like a, allegorically speaking, America got many blessings to be kind of like supercharged with like human growth hormones as a civilization. You know, the same type of things that I would say the blessings of what, unfortunately, what baseball players have done illegally by taking steroids to perform better. So America got very much supercharged to get so in 238 years, much has been accomplished. Much more needs to be accomplished to bring America towards actualization. And I've spoken enough. Now, Alan, please, if you can key off of what Dennis and I have said.
Good morning, Don. How are you doing?
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes, the country, the United States, was founded originally on the principles of religious freedom. The thing is, and this is what I bring out in the book, the problem with the Declaration of Independence was that at that point it was based, the revolution was based on economic factors and political factors, not religious ones. In fact, you know, he brought up the term "In God We Trust." That phrase, actually, the first time it appeared was in Francis Scott Key's "The Star-Spangled Banner." It wasn't put on our currency until the very end of the Civil War, and it wasn't adopted as our official motto until 1956. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you look at the whole arguments. The arguments that they had, the Continental Congress and wanting to build, you know, in Jefferson's later words, a wall of separation between religion and state. I don't see that religion had that much of an effect or reason behind the Declaration.
Mm-hmm. Interesting point. With that being said, we want to go right into reading it, and from the way it's published in Alan's book, it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 pages. I hope we'll be able to cover all of it. And if not, perhaps we'll do it on our future shorter versions of this series, which has been basically secular by design. But this is a special class, which if we don't cover everything today, I think it's important we read through the entire Declaration of Independence, and then we'll go back to the early sections of Alan's book until we finish it. Hopefully by that time, it'll be on the bestsellers list of the New York Times and all the other established mediums which measure the sell of a book. Because, again, Bustos, Alan's book is something to really learn and read and reconsider where we stand as stewards of the earth, which is really ultimately our goal as human beings, serving God and being in fellowship with fellow human beings. Okay, so here we go. I don't have the drum roll. I'll just say it. Here comes the drum roll, virtually speaking. The Declaration of Independence. Where in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are all endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now we're going to review this section of the Declaration of Independence because it's filled with so many potent annotated sources called by Alan in his book. So in terms of the first mentioning of God's name, he's mentioned as nature's God. Now, I don't exactly understand that usage because according to Judaic teachings, we don't talk about nature's God. It seems to me perhaps, and I'll turn to Dennis and Alan for this, it's almost like some sort of dualistic presentation on the part of Jefferson. But aside from that, Cecil brings down in quoting from Pauline Myers' American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence, published by Vintage Books in 1998, contrary to popular belief, the references to God were conspicuously missing in Jefferson's draft and were later added by congressional editors. Now, as well, that the idea that truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, I just want to mention, there is in fact, blessed souls, a source in Torah which in fact bring out this concept of men being all equal before their God, but within a particular context, which you don't really catch the spirit of that as it's mentioned here in the Declaration of Independence. There was a letter written by a Rishon by the name of Ramban, and he wrote a letter to his son, and the content, the intent of the letter was that his son should live in a spirit of humility. So I'm going to read you three brief paragraphs about this idea of the spirit of humility and how it relates to the idea of all men being equal before their Creator. And here it goes. For indeed, of what should a man be prideful? If he has wealth, it is Hashem, God, who makes one prosperous. And if honor, does honor not belong to God? As it is written, wealth and honor come from you, which is talking about God. Book of Chronicles 2, chapter 29, verse 12. How can one glorify himself with the honor of his maker? If he takes pride in wisdom, let him understand that God may remove the speech of the most competent and take away the wisdom of the aged. Book of Job or Eve, chapter 12, verse 20. Thus, and here we go, blessed souls. Thus, Rambam continues, thus, all men stand as equals before their Creator. In his fury he casts down the lofty. In his goodwill he elevates the downtrodden. Therefore humble yourself, for Hashem God will lift you. And concluding, thus I shall explain to you how you may accustom yourself to the quality of humility, to walk with it always. Let your words be spoken gently. Let your heart be bowed. Cast your eyes downward and your heart heavenward. And when speaking, do not stare at your listener. Let all men seem greater than you in your eyes. If another is more wise or wealthy than yourself, you must show him respect. And if he is poor and you are richer or wiser than he, consider that he may be more righteous than yourself. If he sins, it is the result of error, while your transgression is deliberate. So where Jefferson writes we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, unfortunately, it's not lacking that component, which would be from the oral Torah tradition, about the responsibilities of men standing as equals before their Creator, but rather it's, so to speak, like an entitlement. And further on, the idea that we are endowed by, or they are endowed by their Creator, which is they is us and we are them in the history of people living in this country, with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is something that Mr. Cecil brings as a footnote at the end of that statement, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, citing from the American Historical Review that, in fact, Jefferson was culling from philosopher John Locke, who cites authority sparingly, but in his two treatises on government, his citations are almost Calvinistic. Scripture 79 times, 7 Calvinists, Hooker, Silsen, James I. Milton, Hunton, Ainsworth, Selden, 1 ex-Calvinist, and the Dutch Remonstrant Grotius, excuse me. And again, this is by Herbert D. Foster, writing International Calvinism to Locke and the Revolution of 1688, the American Historical Review. Ellen, any takes on the matter that while first, my first question to you is nature's God. I'm a little puzzled. What is Jefferson trying to say, nature's God? Does he mean as we understand that God is the source of nature, or is he talking about some sort of other scenario? I don't relate to this concept of nature's God as a Jew.
Well, as I pointed out in the book from Elaine Pagel's quote from her book, that Jefferson didn't write that. That was added to the manuscript by the congressional editors, Adams, Franklin, Hancock, and some others. People don't understand that there was a lot of editing going on from Jefferson's first draft to the final form. For instance, one of the things that the editors took out was one of Jefferson's complaints was the British support of the slave trade. And they the editors didn't want to anger the delegates from states like South Carolina and Georgia. Mm-hmm. So they removed that part of it. So that is a good question. What does nature's God, what does that mean? What is the, you know, that goes into a whole another discussion about where the Congress was at that time, what they understood it to be, you know, where they got their ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing I forgot to mention, I'd like to ask you about, is this idea that all men are created equal, but that didn't apply to women, because you cite in your book that women in the 18th century America were not treated as equal. However, for instance, where women in ancient Israel could own property, buy and sell property as well, as make their own contracts. So we just want to bring out, blessed souls, that the Torah is not so archaic, and there was a little bit of darkness even in the historical enlightened document of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Again, we're not tearing it apart, but there are certain things where statements were made to the fullness of what everything is implied by all people are created equal. It really didn't apply because, again, you did have this heinous practice of slavery and the unfair treatment of women not being cited as equals. And in fact, you see there is a portion in the Torah where the daughters of Tzalafchad, there were five daughters who did not have a brother to inherit their father's property or riches, and they knew that they were going to eventually settle in the land of Israel, and they went to Moses, and Moses said, "I will have to consult with God." They said, "You are right. God told me that if the women also can inherit land in the land of Israel, and of course that means they could do business. In fact, there were leaders of Israel. The few that we know of, there was Esther, and we also had Deborah the prophet. So again, we're not being anti-American by saying that there was a certain sexist element in the very Declaration of Independence. But again, people argue that, well, those were the values of those times. But the values of those times needed some correction, and we're still trying to repair that damage in the 21st century based on how this Declaration of Independence was written, with all of its positive points and the things which need to be rectified, hopefully through proper human conduct. Now, Dennis, your take on these matters.
Yes, I was happy to hear that you picked up on the word God in that economic document, because these people who came here came with luggage, baggage of their history in Europe. And you got to remember that they were farmers, and they placed a great deal of faith in Mother Nature, but they associated that everything was directed by God. Now, one other point that to me is very important here, and it also covers, I believe, Alan's objective in the book, and that is all nations profess and have wonderful ideas, and they're very creative, just like Thomas Jefferson wrote here, yet editors nibbled away at it, we'll say. However, it really comes down to what they practice, not what they preach, because you preach wonderful words, beautiful things, but what you practice is just as, or probably more important than what you preach. Now, take the example of all men are equal. Now, that was a great saying, yet we know that if you weren't owning land in America, you weren't there. You weren't important enough. If you didn't own land, you were not equal. Now, that was inherent in the people who came over here and bought the land and took care of the land and associated it with God and Mother Nature and covered everything. But equality, was it really practiced when this country was founded?
True. I want, before I turn to Alan for further embellishment commentary, there's a note that's brought after this first portion of the Declaration of Independence that Alan wrote down. I think it's very important to share with everyone listening live, or hopefully will listen in the archive version. Note, however grand these concepts are, there is a problem with these truths being self-evident. Quote, that these truths were not understood as self-evident in themselves, but functionally and politically self-evident only, is suggested by a variety of other facts. Neither Jefferson nor any other thinker of his generation referred to these propositions as self-evident in any other place, or as far as any other scholar of the period has shown, even though the members of the revolutionary generation frequently discoursed on the very truths outlined in the Declaration. There were many men who did view these truth is self-evident, such as the 22 black slaves of Thomas Jefferson, who took Lord John Dunsmore up on his offer, which was that basically, what was that? No, we'll just leave that there. On gaining their freedom if they joined the loyalist cause. The subjective concept of happiness is a bit of a problem here. Owning female slaves and legally being allowed to rape them daily was also a source of quote-unquote happiness to many southern plantation owners, such as Thomas Jefferson. Obviously, there are problems with the self-evidence of what constitutes, quote, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, at which point Allen quotes from the collective writings of Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, a 19th century rabbi who lived in Germany, who writes the following. As long as freedom, right, independence, and human dignity are taught, demonstrated, and defended only by men, and from the standpoint of men, all chance of universal harmony will be demolished by the natural dissimilarity among men. The strong will continue to say to the weak and master to the servant, quote, I am more than you, otherwise I would not be your master, end of quote. Alan, any take on these matters?
Well, the whole idea, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, this is something that was brought up earlier. The people who had the quality were white male property owners, African-American slaves, women, Native Americans. None of these people had any rights.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very limiting. And also, I going back to the argument of the nation being, you know, the America was settled for religious freedom, the members of the Continental Congress who adopted the Declaration of Independence, these were the top tier of society. These were businessmen, politicians, lawyers. Most of them, I think close to three-quarters of them were lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that it was, I think it's very clear that the people who drafted the Constitution, who voted on it, who signed it, these were not, you know, the common American, you know, Joe Sixpack, if you want to call him that. You know, these were the what a lot of people describe as the 1%. These were the top economic political leaders of the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just want to mention one more thing before we read further into the Declaration of Independence. When I look as a Jew who learns Torah and seeks to fulfill as many commandments, mitzvahs as possible, when I look at this Creator, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I'd like to put on my seven Noahide commandment shades or spectacles and say that the inalienable rights that Creator has given us is that we have the right not to be forced to serve idols. We have the right not to be forced to blaspheme Creator. We have the right not to be murdered by someone who premeditates upon our demise. Number four, we have the right not to be forced into having our properties stolen from us in a way that's premeditated by others. Number five, we have the right not for others to steal our family members or to seduce our children or wives or vice versa, or if our husbands shouldn't be seduced by other women. Number six, now this one, it's a little bit harder to connect, that we should not be, but I will mention it, this is something which applies specifically, more specific to the children of Noah than children of Israel. We have the right not to have meat which has been slaughtered before the animal is completely dead. And number six, we should be allowed to raise up judicial systems which will enforce these commandments. Again, these seven core commandments of the seven Noahic commandments are, in fact, I think, the Founding Fathers might not have been thinking about that, but I do believe if the seven Noahic commandments were to be brought down to the level of secular law into American society, more Americans than not, and in increasing numbers, a way of greater strength and greater dignity, would be experiencing life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness within a certain structure provided by Torah, but yet secularized into law in a way they wouldn't feel threatened that it's a mixing of religion
and the mixing of religion and God. Alan, your take on these matters.
Well, the I think on the seventh law, the law of Benin, of social justice,
right.
Rambam had his point was that it was do not fail to create courts of justice.
Mm-hmm.
This was argued. Nachmanides, the Ramban, had a different view of this, of course,
mm-hmm.
but the you know, it wasn't so much of a freedom to create courts; it was a prohibition against lawlessness.
Right.
We are supposed to have law. We are supposed to have an ordered society, and the whole concept that we have with the Noahide laws. One thing I think needs to be brought out is the whole concept of rights. You know, I wrote in the book a century before this, the writings of John Selden were very popular. He wrote about the Noahide laws, and
mm-hmm.
through the philosophers changed the legal Noahide law into this kind of they kind of obfuscated the concept and turned it into rights. You know, what is the
uh-huh.
difference between God's law and then these basic universal rights? I think that, going back to what we were talking about, nature's God, the whole point of, you know, did God command us specific prohibitions that we are supposed to follow, or are these some sort of, you know, basic rights that everyone is supposed to have? Again, it goes back to what do you base this authority on, and what exactly is it? What are rights?
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your take on these matters.
We cannot define intangibles. The more you try to define them, the weaker the whole concept gets. So you can't say, since everybody's entitled to happiness, we're going to give you a little piece of paper that says, here is happiness and you can have it. No, you can't say you're entitled to only good things. Bad things shouldn't happen to you. These are intangibles that are based on human values, human interpretation. And it goes back to Thomas Jefferson where he uses the beautiful words self-evident. He belonged to the elitist group, as Alan pointed out. That's correct. But when he said self-evident, it means that I can see it. But he begs the question, can you see it? Well, that's up in the human mind. What is self-evident? It's not necessarily self-evident because it's a personal thing. And trying to get humans to agree on the same idea is not an easy thing to do. I don't care if you're in America or any other place. So we have to worry about that. If you create a bunch of things of pros and cons, are you really trying to define something by whittling away at the edges and the peripheral and saying what is left is the truth? I don't know if that's the best logical way of going about it.
Hmm. Okay.
I'd like to jump in here real quick,
yes,
if I could.
Yes,
I totally agree. Rabbi Hirsch expressed the same opinion. You know, he said, you know, that you know, source of happiness to an alcoholic would be his next bottle of whiskey. I mean, you know, what is the definition of happiness?
Right.
You know, it's so variable from each person, and that is what the problem is about self-evident happiness. So I totally agree with what he was saying.
Okay, great. With that being said, I'd like to read further, gentlemen, and bless the souls listening out there. Further into the Declaration of Independence, going further, which at this point most people have not read, including myself up until recently. In fact, I just want to mention that I have to admit that my first true insight into the Declaration of Independence was not by reading about it, not really learning about it in school when I was growing up in secular school as a young boy up until the age of like 10 or 11 years old. It was because my parents took me to a play, I think it was in 1972 or 1973, to see a play, it was a Broadway show called 1776. And there I was given, at least through the play, of course, with plays and Hollywood and all these type of mediums have the distortions, but you were given a definite sense of the ambivalence that was going on amongst the colony leaders that were gathered in Philadelphia with the skirmish that took place between John Adams and the delegates from South Carolina who wanted the point about slavery struck out, and if it wasn't struck out, they weren't going to sign, and therefore there wouldn't be a Declaration of Independence. And at least as the play portrayed it, that Benjamin Franklin told John Adams, basically you have to make a compromise at a future date. It doesn't mean it's going to be like this, you know, forever. So I just want to show that this point most people have not read, including myself up until recently when I had the fortune to purchase Mr. Cecil's book, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of No Hide Laws and Observances. And let's go further into the Declaration of Independence. That to secure these rights, governments, and the rights we just mentioned before, those inalienable rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers to such form, as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness, prudence, indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experiences have shown, that was 18th century English, that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than the right themselves by abolishing the forms by which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such has been now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain, of course, we're talking about 18th century King of Great Britain, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having its direct object, and the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. Before we go further, in terms of that to secure these rights, Mr. Cecil left us a footnote here, culling from Hirsch's collective writing from page 157, as long as bias and weakness, narrowness and passion, self-seeking and self-interest will dictate the laws of mankind, the vision of mankind will continually be blurred, and the only right which will be holy will be the one which men demand and which suits their desire. But the right that they should have appreciated and practiced all along, obscured in the glaring of their self-seeking, is actually quite different than the general perception of quote-unquote right. That is how the annals of mankind came to be written with tears and blood. And that gives me pause to think deeply into what Rav Hirsch wrote. And even in the Declaration of Independence, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. So a lot of people talking today about attempts to abolish or alter it. I don't know about abolishing, but altering the Declaration or the Constitution. But in fact, not that I'm justifying anyone's right to alter it, that we should become a crueler society, God forbid, or to have laws which are akin to the laws of Sodom and Gomorrah. But Alan, I don't think many people realize that the American Declaration of Independence has embedded with it the right that the whole government structure of this blessed land and country can go through rectification and ultimately elevation. Your take on these matters?
Well, Jefferson himself said that he thought that the Constitution should be rewritten after a certain period of time. He was all in favor of that. A couple months ago, I got into an argument with someone who did not like my comments about the Constitution, and I read him this passage about, you know, the right to change the government, and he told me that what I was saying was treason, and I told him, yes, it is treason. It was written by one of the greatest traitors in history, a guy named Thomas Jefferson, and he was just flabbergasted. So many people so many people. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening. I'm listening.
Well, listen, Alan.
You know, they read, and this was my experience too growing up. You know, you hear, you study about the Declaration of Independence, and the only people really knew very well was the preamble. That is what most people are familiar with, what most people read, study, and they don't really read the meat and potatoes, so to speak, of the Declaration, what the Declaration was all about, which is what we're about to go into.
Right, right. Dennis, your take on these matters?
I agree with Alan. He sees it from a different angle than most people, because, again, most people take it as a written document as opposed to theories and practices and implications behind the words. However, I believe, personally, that when God created the human race, he invited with a certain amount of change or adjustments that can be done. And that's why our race still exists today, because we've gone through so many of these changes. Now, I'm not saying total banishment, forbidding, and other things is in the mainstream, but change is always there. And the one thing that I always like, and I think Alan picked up on part of this, even though he may have not have mentioned it, is that as each generation comes through, they want to do something a little bit different than the previous generation. Now, the Hasidim have been fighting this for a long time, but that's the way it goes with human nature, Don. However, the change keeps happening. Do we come to full circles over the years? Yes, we do. Does that stop the change? No, it doesn't. It just keeps on going. Humans are somewhat restless type of people, but we need a firmness, an order, a belief that we can keep us all together, regardless of how we want to change. So I'm happy that we keep the extremes on the edge and not in the mainstream.
True. Gentlemen, with that being said, before I read the facts be submitted to the Canada War, basically the listing by Jefferson of the offenses committed by the English monarchy against the 13 colonies at that time, I'd like to just take a brief musical break because it's the type of song which kind of, again, puts an umbrella, I think, over this whole conversation of remembering or reminding us as human beings from where we come from. We all come, every one of us, Jew and Gentile, as for those of us who believe literally from the biblical perspective, that we all are descendants of Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And this song was written by a very good friend of mine, Joseph Israel, who wrote a song called His Water, where he implores us to consider from whose water are we drinking from. And we do humbly suggest that the human family experience will greatly benefit to drink from Abrahamic waters, which are the waters of Torah. And this is a 4 minute and 13 second beautiful song composed by Joseph Israel, who told me that this song was actually composed coming from inspiration. He called from actually spending a Shabbat meal with him and his blessed wife, Karina Christie Fennell, and the members of his band, the Jerusalem Band, way back in 2008. This is His Water by Joseph Israel. 4 minutes and 13 seconds of words and music to meditate upon. Bless those. Hold on and enjoy.
If we all love each other,
Joseph Israel, his water. Now we're going to go right into the complaints, the tainas, as we would say in Ivrit, in Hebrew, that Thomas Jefferson, empowered, emboldened by the other colonial leaders at that time, what were the transgressions of the British Empire, the monarchy of England, against the 13 colonies? Number one, he's not listed number one, I'm just going to say number one. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he is utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies of places unusual, uncomfortable and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers incapable of annihilation have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the states remaining in the meantime exposed to all dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for the purpose of obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws by establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent and superior to civil power. I guess the British army that were located on the American colonies saw the American soil at that time. He has combined with others to subject us to jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases the benefit of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislators and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging wars against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled, in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections against us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an indistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince, whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant, is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in our attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislator to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They have been too deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that word correctly, we must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace friends. I'll conclude the Declaration of Independence. I'm glad we were able to get through it, and we'll review with Alan, Dennis and Alan on what we've just read. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress, assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be fully dissolved, and that as a free and independent states, they have the power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. So there you have it, Blessed Souls. That is, in fact, the complete reading, which I did not expect to read the entirety of it, but we did, and we still have another hour to go, so we can roll back to these egregious offenses as written down by Jefferson. And I'd like to go back. Well, first of all, let me get some feedback from Alan and Dennis on this. Alan?
Well, one of the things that is so disturbing when reading through these offenses is that many of them have been committed by our own government. That's, you know, people who say, oh, you shouldn't criticize the government or you shouldn't criticize the Constitution.
That's self-evident?
It's self-evident. You got that, Dennis. It's, you know, we have committed a lot of the same offenses, and many of them recently, like, being thrown in jail without a trial is what we've done to people in Guantanamo.
That's right.
And other places as well, having a standing army. We always had a volunteer army until about 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago. Now we have an independent standing army. You can go over so many of the injustices that are listed in the Declaration and see that we have actually committed them ourselves.
True. I would just like to comment before I turn to Dennis that this particularly strikes me because this is a very fiery, controversial issue now. One of the grievances held against the monarchy of England is that for that purpose, obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners and refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. This is a fiery statement of accusation here because there's a great debate. How many people do we let into our country? Well, the question is it that question, or is it to whose benefit and to whose detriment are we really talking about? And I have my own take on this matter because we have a situation in Israel where many Sudanese, because of the viciousness of the civil war that's taken place between northern Sudan and southern Sudan, even after the Declaration of Independence of Sudan, many Sudanese have come in. And there's been a lot of tension in the land of Israel because, unfortunately, they come from war-torn, traumatized land, or lands, if before it used to be two countries, or it was one country, now it's two, that there were murders and there were raping of Israeli women and mugging of people. And my proposed solution for the Americas, as well as for Israel, for anyone to make a migration here, is to ask them on a secular level, will they agree to not violate, at least at the very basic minimum, of not to murder, not to steal, not to commit, you know, and we can go into other laws as well, but I'm just the very, do you promise to be loyal to this country and not to pillage and not to serve as a catalyst for enemy forces which are trying to sneak through the borders of America? Now, I don't know if I'm Mr. Patriot, but I do believe that there should be a uniform standard in Israel as well as in America. So this idea that the limiting of the laws of naturalization for foreigners, the very people who are against the people today of just black and in a very blank, clear black and white fashion, restricting the immigration of other people to this country who come from oppressed conditions, well, these people are sounding a little bit like the students of King George. Dennis?
Don, there are no guarantees that humans won't sin. No matter what they attest to, no matter how it's notarized, to say that humans will guarantee no sin is a little stretch of the imagination, okay? Because we as a human race are restless. We get involved in change because we feel like we're creating some bad habits and we have to change. It may not be logical reasoning, but we as humans have heuristic processes that we follow, and it can't be stopped. The same thing with movement. If people feel that they're getting a wrong deal in one place, they're going to figure out there must be a better place. It isn't a question of politics here. It's humans getting together and having a commonality that they're going to follow. very hard for governments to stop, rearrange, direct, and stop that. The Iron Curtain came down because people didn't want it.
True.
Nazism was destroyed by people who said, we got to stop it. But until those things happen and people rise up, you can call it a revolution if you want to, fine. But you have to remember that we've always had this debate between a terrorist and a patriot. Sometimes people from one side will say you're a terrorist, another side they'll say you're a patriot. So we as humans have this duality that depending on the circumstances and the situation, it tends to evolve and we cannot ignore it. So, yes, immigration will always be a problem. Can you build a fence or a wall high enough that will stop everything? The Great Wall of China, it didn't work. Hadrian's Wall in England, it worked partially for a period of time. But those walls are crumbled, but they're still there, but they're crumbling. And everybody goes back as tourist attractions saying, gee, I wonder why they built that wall. Yet we have 52,000 children of Central America, South America descendancy that have come into our borders on the southern part of the United States, and we're setting up encampments for them. Where do you draw the line? If they're sending all the children, can you really push children back? Or maybe you don't have the laws, or maybe the laws forgot about children? I don't know. But we as humans have to face this. And this is one of the reasons why Alan has this book, as I believe it, is that some of these things that sound like they were settled or decided years ago, humans don't stop. We keep creating, revisiting, going back over. So we need some substance to go by. And the only thing I can see is our basic faith and belief that keeps us going.
Alan, I want to respond, Dennis, but I first want to turn to Alan for perspective on these matters.
Well, I was wondering if you would be interested in reading the footnote 32 on the second half of page 475, the footnote that right up at the end of the Declaration.
I'll be happy to read it, and then please chime in with your comment,
sure.
and then. Okay, footnote 32, which followed the statement at the conclusion of the Declaration of Independence, which we'll read, and for the support of the Declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, mutually...
475.
Yeah. No, I'm reading the part that leads up to footnote 32, which is basically you annotated it at the conclusion of the Declaration of Independence. I'm just
want
to read that just to give people a context from which this note is springing from. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. From which point, Alan quotes the following. The only part of the Declaration of Independence most people are familiar with is the stirring sentence at the beginning, quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These ringing words seem discongruous with the rest of the Declaration, which mainly deals with political and economic issues. This famous phrase also has a disturbingly hollow tone to it when one realizes that the author, Thomas Jefferson, was an elitist white slave owner. Maurice Samuel has a different take on the concept of quote-unquote sacred honor spoken of by the signers of the Declaration. This difference in behavior and reaction springs from something much more earnest and significant than a difference in beliefs. It is a difference in the taking of life which cannot be argued. You have your way of life, we ours. In your system of life, we are essentially quote-unquote without honor. In our system of life, you are essentially without morality. In your system of life, we forever appear graceless. To us, you must forever appear godless. And this is a book, I never read this book. This is written by by Maurice Samuel called You Gentiles, which I guess there's some pretty stinging points made by Mr. Samuels, which was a book written back in the 1920s, I think,
That was a footnote in Alan's book?
Yeah, I'm going to continue because the footnote's not finished.
Because it sounds like it should be a chapter.
For those who think Samuel's views harsh and unfair, it should be pointed out that Maurice Samuel wrote, quote-unquote, "You Gentiles," in response to the passing of the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924, which was called at that point the Anti-Immigration Act, which effectively slammed the door of escape of the tired, poor, homeless, huddled masses of tempest-tossed Jews from the old world who were yearning to breathe free on our teeming shore. Samuel well understood that the signers of the Declaration of Independence were themselves descendants of immigrants who fled the old world because of religious persecution, and that these same white Christian immigrants who came to the new world took the land from the Native American Indians by force of arms, killing the Native Americans and driving the rest into the wild, the arid deserts of the West, then hypocritically denying immigration to others suffering religious persecution, particularly the Jews, whom even Jefferson thought, quote-unquote, repulsive and antisocial, end of quote. Seen in this light, Samuel's words would become chillingly prophetic in less than a decade, quote, "The demand for racial homogeneity within the state has led in America to the exclusion of the immigrant and particularly of the immigrant who will not lend himself to this to the type of assimilation or self-destruction which you demand. When the Jew emigrates from one country to another, it is almost invariably under the pressure of persecution. He that refuses asylum to a victim fleeing from a murder is, before God, a freeing and willing accomplice in the crime." Very powerful point, Alan. Now, can you please add any other comments you wish to make?
Well, the whole concept of the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Independence was pretty much forgotten soon after it was written. We fought the war, we drafted the Articles of Confederation, then the Constitution, and interestingly, it was Jefferson wanting to secure his legacy who was the first one to kind of push for the remembrance and recognition of the Declaration of Independence. He was the one who suggested to John Turnbull, the one to paint the famous painting of the signing of the Declaration of Independence that I think hangs in the rotunda of the Capitol today.
Mm-hmm.
But the main interpretation, today's view of the Declaration being this, you know, great, holy document, was really first started by Abraham Lincoln when he was debating Douglas in the Lincoln-Douglas debates when he was running for president. Mm-hmm. And it was over the issue of slavery, you know, the whole all men are created equal sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole mythology and symbolism of the Declaration, you know, is more of an interpretation. That's, you know, again, when you read the whole body of the Declaration of Independence, once you get past that first preamble, it has to do with political and economic issues. Nothing but, it's not about religion, it's not about, you know, as far as equality or anything, it has to do with political and economic issues.
True. And with that being said, Dennis, I just want to chime back to something now that we can't expect people not to sin. But when we talk about transgressions or illegal acts, let's use it in modern terms, of murder and stealing, we're talking about two very bad vices which destabilize the host country when new people come in. Now, for an adult who has come from a war-torn or oppressive society, as is being claimed by those coming in from Central America, South America, or even from Mexico, where certainly the people oppressed being caught in the middle of those evil and heinous warlord drug wars, where so many people's lives are just taken wantonly, whether just being caught in a crossfire or because they're the relative of someone else who's a part of another drug gang. It's a very big problem. Now, as far as the children, now, of course, different standards must be exercised, of course, and of course, a five-year-old really, it's hard to make a five-year-old accountable for what they're going to do, but most five-year-olds are not going to be involved. They might be involved in petty theft, just out of deprivation or desperation. Of course, most of them will not be involved in premeditated murder. I just want to mention, too, that as far as Israelite Jewish law concerns, when we had our own sovereignty. We don't, from the Jewish law perspective, have true sovereignty in the land of Israel right now, which unfortunately is part and parcel of the fact that the modern state of Israel is not a Torah-oriented government, but rather it's a vassal state for whatever country or human principalities you might want to say. I don't want to go further than that. That in the Commonwealth, the ancient Commonwealth of Israel, according to the oral Torah tradition, when a Gentile would want to make a choice to live in the land of Israel, that they were expected to make a declaration before a Jewish court, and I don't know if it was just three, maybe it was more than three rabbinical judges, that in fact they would accept upon themselves the seven Noahide commandments. As well, if a slave had escaped from a neighboring country, or even a distant country, and they made it to the land of Israel, the Israelite was commanded by the Creator that we are not allowed to return that slave who has fled his or her country of original slavery. We were not allowed to return them. So we are not allowed to return former captives or slaves back to their former slave owners if they came from another country. And also, we were expected to not only accept the Gentiles' request to live in our land, but we were also required, something I don't think I mentioned before, we were required to financially support them, giving them the means by which they can live in the land of Israel. So when I think it was recently that President Obama wanted $2 billion set aside for, I think, the children coming in, this is not really necessary. I mean, I don't think President Obama learns the seven Noahide commandments, unfortunately, or is aware of perhaps this aspect of Israelite ancient Commonwealth law, which is really still a law which is applicable. Again, we don't have sovereignty in our land because the modern government of Israel is not a Torah-oriented government, though they pay face value homage to it, having two chief rabbis. There is a place to hold a human being accountable to not be anti-societal as a condition for them having the right to move into the new land, in particularly in the United States of America. I just wanted to mention that. Dennis, of course, I'll turn to you, and then Alan for feedback.
Don, that doesn't obviate the need that the parents who created the child have the responsibility. It isn't that the U.S. government, because it has an open and fair policy, is going to allow all those parents to send their kids to our country.
Right.
You cannot take a good idea and spread it over a bad one. You cannot take a good idea and degrade it to the point that you're using it for something that's contrary to the original principle. So I understand what you're saying, and that's why we have mighty minds who decide those problems when one law interferes with another, one principle interferes with another. But that doesn't mean it satisfies everybody.
True.
But then again, we do put God and trust in all our government money.
Right. Alan?
Well, two points I would like to make. One, you know, you're talking about theft. The law of theft, it's a prohibition for all mankind under the Noahide Code.
That's right.
We, you know, there's, like you pointed out, you know, there's a huge debate right now about all the Hispanic immigrants coming in, especially in the Southwest United States.
Mm-hmm.
I think I need to point out that we stole that land from Mexico. The entire Southwest of the United States was once a part of Mexico, and we went to war against Mexico to take that land away from them.
True.
I mean, it was originally their land. That kind of raises some disturbing points of, you know, what exactly is our right to keep these people out of our country. The second point I wanted to make was that non-Jews who wanted to live in the land of Israel had to, you know, accept the Noahide law. That is true. But according to many rabbinic opinions, especially Rabad and Ramban, they were the opinion that Israel could not enforce the Noahide law upon neighboring nations that Israel conquers militarily, let alone Gentile nations over which it has no control. In other words, they only the application of Noahide law they could only enforce within the borders of the land of Israel.
True. That again, that's their opinion. And you know, even the Lubavitch Rebbe, who was who since about 1963 until his ascension to the next level of life in 94, talked about the idea that we're basically trying to arouse the nations of the world to prepare the world. We're not going to be able to, it would be quite miraculous to see the full implementation of the seven oil commandments as secular law outside of the land of Israel. And again, it will be upon not the Jews, but the Gentile nations outside of Israel, the land of Israel proper, who will be responsible for following these laws. I mean, I can foresee in the future after the Mashiach, the Messiah comes, that there will be correspondences. How do we, you know, if there are questions of how to administrate or implement these laws for the proper structuring of society. But yes, I mean, the idea that we should be telling, you know, I'm saying as a Jew, we are suggesting and we are imploring the nations of the world, wherever they may be, to consider implementing into their already existing societies these seven universal laws, which, again, encompass more than just that. I mean, basically, that's what I have to, you know, of course, we're not, here for me, myself, as one little Jew living in Brooklyn, I can verbally engage someone. I mean, the Lashon of Rambam is lekofeh, to compel, but after that speech, there's nothing else I can do other than to apply to appeal to their sense of decency to consider, you know, God's law. And again, they don't have to we're not looking to turn America into one giant synagogue. That's not the point of the seven oil commandments, but to give structure to this Western civilization, which unfortunately is cracking at the seams with certain pillars of society. For instance, the pillar of society, which is family, is harshly being attacked now because of the forces of economic woes, which are basically, which I've spoke with my Rav, that the economic woes in this world are primarily not just because of a lack of belief in God, or lack of love and fear of God, but the lack of implementation of Torah law, how to run an honest business. Unfortunately, there's too much dishonesty and deception and outright stealing and infringement of copyrights, which undermines and supplants the security, which, I mean, this country should be a manufacturing giant by virtue of its length, width, and breadth and physical size, and yet instead we're getting obfuscated by all these issues, which we're not going to diminish the importance of, say, the immigration issues or the drug issues, and myself being a member of the mental health field. We're in a crisis with mental health here in America. The question is, what can help us bring back this country and other countries around the world? And the Rebbe used to point out that America can serve as a beacon of light for other nations based on the fact that people can freely practice their faith-based practices. So I just want to chime in with that response. Anyone want to respond?
Yeah, I agree with what you say, Don, but it's easy to come out with the theory. It's very hard to practice. But I have my faith in people, and if people make up their mind that they want something to happen or occur, they're going to do it. The question is that the Lubavitch rabbi had the same problem that we all have, and that is, how can we get a bunch of people to think about the same thing that will be beneficial to everybody? It is not easy. But we keep on trying, Don. That's why we have this program, hoping to wake up a kernel in people's minds.
It's true. Alan?
Yeah, we have the In God We Trust on the money. The United States is one of the most, quote-unquote, religious countries in Western civilization. But, you know, it makes you wonder if the Gentiles have even read the Tanakh. To understand what is going to happen to them if they don't adopt these laws. So many people here are so convinced by the propaganda you know, that, oh, we're the best, we have the best government, the best way of life, you know, we're the good guys in the white hats. But what is the Torah standard? You know, how does it compare? You know, we might compare ourselves to Somalia or Iran, but how do we measure up what the Torah says we're supposed to do? That is the big question to me.
True. I hear you. I don't have the answer aside from to encourage people to learn to read the Tanakh. I want to bring out something here which is probably one of the more disturbing, if not the most disturbing, section of the Declaration of Independence for me, which I really struggle with, and of course I'll be turning to Dennis and Alan for feedback, where it says here that he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So Alan planted beautifully footnote number 30 after the statement, he has excited domestic insurrections against us, which really opens up a whole can of worms, is by the following quotation that Alan pulls from Sidney Kaplan's The Domestic Insurrections of the Declaration of Independence, taken from the Journal of Negro History, Volume 61, Number 3, July 1976, page 253. This was actually an open rebuke for King George III for storing up revolt amongst the black slaves. Quote, in his final charge against George III, quote, he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and endeavored us to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, an indictment of the monarch for stirring up an enslaved and oppressed people to seek their freedom from freedom-seeking revolutionaries. The declaration is perhaps doubly flawed. And I just want to mention something here before I turn to Alan Dennis on this. Last week I was listening into a broadcast. It's called Democracy Now!, which is put out by Amy Goodman, no relation to me, where she interviewed a African-American professor, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, who mentioned that at the time, or preceding the time of the American Revolution, of course, the Declaration of Independence of 1776, that in fact there was a growing abolition movement in England for the ending of slavery. And there is a perspective, according to this African-American professor, that the American Revolution was in fact a revolution against the abolition of slavery of the Africans. And I just want to mention something. To me, it is very heinous to have called the Indians merciless Indian savages. I mean, Rabboni Sholem, parents of the genocide, as a member of a people, and all peoples have been through horrible periods of time, blessed souls, the Indian came, according to Indian perspective, from what I've listened to American Indians on the radio, I've read their blogs, they consider World War I to have started in 1620 when the pilgrims came over. And I heard from one Indian in discussions of the idea to missionize them to Christianity, that I think it was in Virginia or in the Carolinas, there was a mass conversion of Native Americans. And one of the reasons why we call the beginning of the show Turtle Island, because there are groups of Indians who called this land Turtle Island before it was called the United States of America, that after the conversion of over 100 Native peoples of this land, they were mowed down by the muskets of those days. So are we calling them savages? Can we understand? I'm not justifying their savagery, but I can understand I can understand why they took the role they did, and I can also understand why the African American slaves would want to rebel against the colonies, and why they would choose to side on the side of King George III, because the whole intent of the colonies was to continue with the slave trade, and they were given an opportunity to be freed. And to this day, we are still plagued with both of these peoples feeling very bruised and traumatized, just as Jews have been traumatized, and the Irish have been traumatized by the English, and the Indian people have been traumatized by the British, and so on and so on. The Shias are traumatized by the Sunni, and vice versa. And by the way, blessed souls, we have now, right now as we speak in 2014 on the Declaration of Independence Day, July 4th, we have now an emerging caliphate called ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which is calling all people with the same type of protestations against Western nationalistic thought, making the same claims on the West as we had made on the East in relation to us, the monarchy of England. I'm just trying to, you know, we're going into like a Talmudic style type of reasoning, but so please, please supple and flexible in your mind. We're not for dismantling America, but this part of the Declaration of Independence, I really struggle to look at because as one group, as a member of one nation that has been treated brutally throughout the ages, and thank God since the last 100 years or so, the blows have been softened by the graces God has given to the America to be a little more tolerant of us, which all people should be tolerant of other people. I just want to mention this part of the Declaration of Independence really, really should have a big asterisk ended to it, that this, you know, to testify for all ages until, you know, wherever we consider to be the end of time, which the truth is there's no end of time in the Creator's plan, that people should understand that there was a great gap in consciousness on the part of those who formulated, particularly Thomas Jefferson, in the writing Declaration of Independence, that who were they to call the Indian savages when the savagery that was committed against the American Indian and the heinous crimes committed against the Africans being brought unduly to America. And some people have argued that, well, you know, the Africans were selling off the Africans off to the Muslims or the other European traders. So be it, that was, they'll have to, there are consequences for their actions too. But the fact that the people agreed to transport them from their native land in Africa to here, you know, it's very understandable why they would have sided with King George. Dennis, I know you wanted to chime in.
Yeah, Don, you got to remember the who, what, when, and where. When the Declaration of Independence was written, it was written by our forefathers who basically came from Europe with European ideas, European baggage, and a lot of other European stuff. And right. What they did, if you weren't white Caucasian, you were considered a savage. Because you were uneducated, you were poor, you didn't come from a wealthy family. I can go on and on and on. I, just like you did with the list of those things, of things that they didn't like about the King of England. But it carried over here. You couldn't get that out of the speech if the elite people in Europe said, if you weren't a Caucasian, you're a savage. Well, they treated everybody who wasn't white as a savage. But at that time, that's what they were doing. Now, what's bothering you is that we've transferred some of those ideas to the modern day. Yes, it happens. Humans are not perfect. Can they get rid of all the old lineage, the old baggage, and other things like that? You open this program by saying, well, we're a relatively new nation. Can we? Can we change over a period of time? But change doesn't happen by pressing a button. But I can sympathize with you, but I think you have to have a little bit more understanding. Not an understanding about the injustice, about the understanding of where it began.
I hear Dennis. Alan?
Well, the problem with Western civilization has to do, it goes all the way back to the conflict between Jacob and his brother Esau. Esau, according to a majority of the sages and commentators, was the founder of the Roman Empire. And Rome, of course, had conquered Western Europe. So many of these ideas that we have came from Rome, the enemy of Israel. And look, you know, you look at how our government is structured. You know, the Senate, our buildings are modeled after Greek and Roman architecture. We use Latin in our language is half Latin. Latin is the official language of our legal system. We even have Latin on our money, you know, instead of Hebrew. So this is the whole purpose of the Noahide Law. We have to understand that perhaps it is our foundation of society, not being based on Torah, but on these other, you know, man-made concepts, Esavian, if you will, concepts that have just permeated our culture, you know, our values. And this is the problem we face. And the solution to this, I think, really begins with education. Like Dennis said, you know, it's what we're doing on this program. We've got to educate people that, hey, there is a better system. There is a better way. You can appeal to people who are religious from the religious standpoint, but I believe, too, that we can appeal to the intellectual that, you know, there's a logic and reason behind the laws of the Torah, and it is a much better system than the one we have now.
True. I want to fuse together both Dennis' point and Alan's point in saying that together, that to me, there's a synchronistic Hashkacha Pratis, divine providence type of fusion here, which I want to adhere to. But before we go further, Buster, I want to take one more little musical break, because this is a song which kind of also ties into that revolutionary spirit that was not only for those days, it was something that was very prevalent in the 1960s, and it's something which, listen, if you are for the sake of rectifying creation, improving it, and in a way that it should not seem ethereal to other human beings, but in a very practical, common sense manner which can be intellectually understood, then you are in fact a revolutionary. You might not be walking around with a uniform, you might not be walking around with drums and, you know, fife and drums, but in fact you are, because remember, in the word revolution, blessed souls, you have the word evolution. And if there's no evolution, there's no revolution. But anyway, I want to play a song which will, I'm sure, will ring very clearly in the ears of Alan and Dennis. And for those of you who are a little bit older than 20 years old, Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth, and then we're going to run into the final segment of our program. It's about 2 minutes and 37 seconds. It's very thought-provoking lyrics with some nice music. Hold on, Blessed Souls.
But it still ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. It's time we stop. Hey, what the sound? Everybody look what's going down. Carrying signs, mostly saying hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Paranoia strikes deep into your life. It will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
That was Buffalo Springfield, and in fact, Dennis and I, we have a mystery caller in, so we're going to bring him or her in and get their feedback, and we'll have a round t- roundtable discussion about what we've been talking about, anything, new points that you gentlemen want to bring in, or this surprise caller might want to contribute. Let's see who it is. Good afternoon. Let's see. Good afternoon, blessed caller. Would you like to identify yourself and where you're calling from?
My name is Doris. I'm calling from Houston, and blessings for you.
Thank you, Doris. So you joined us last Sunday. Thank you for coming back on. You co-hosted with Dennis, and we now have Alan Cecil, who wrote a wonderful book called Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. And, Doris, how long have you been listening to today's humble effort?
I really just like in the last few minutes.
Okay, so it's hard for me to bring you up to date over an hour and 40 minutes, but we were talking about the Declaration of Independence and the historical benchmark it made on the human family experience, and there are some flaws in consciousness within it. We just most notably talked about the idea that, the idea that Jefferson asserted that one of the grievances cited against the monarchy of England was the idea of he had engaged the merciless Indian savages, who in fact were treated very mercilessly, without mercy, I should say, by the European colonial peoples and those who found the country and found out there were people living there before them, and also that one of the grievances stated against the King of England was the fact that King George had in fact supported the revolt amongst African-American slaves to go up against the colonies. And you mentioned that there was in fact a professor I heard on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Program that in fact there is a viewpoint from the viewpoint of this professor that in fact the revolution that we are celebrating today, the Declaration of Independence, was actually anti-revolutionary against the abolition movement, which was gaining strength in England because the colonies wanted to retain their African slaves. With that being said, Alan, you mentioned to me, and I'd like to bring this out into public, that your father was involved working in the movement with Dr. Martin Luther King as African Americans were seeking to become more empowered. Can you talk a little bit about that and the difficulties your father had in trying to help another man or another man representing other groups of people here in America become more, quote-unquote, equal among other men under the eyes of the Creator?
Yes, both my parents were involved in the civil rights movement back in the 60s. In fact, one of my earliest experiences in Milwaukee, I was taken out of the school I was in. This was back in 1965, I believe, and put into what was called a freedom school. I was the token honky. My mom marched at Selma. They were friends of Dr. King, Andrew Young. In fact, my father was invited. He was invited to when Andrew Young was made the ambassador to the United Nations. He was invited to the White House, mm-hmm. for the ceremony. But yeah, it was a really difficult time. It's the whole thing about persecution I can really identify with. Our family was not very popular living in Atlanta back in the 60s, to say the least. We were on the wrong team, so to speak. Most of the people, I grew up with an enormous amount of hostility being directed towards me, and I know my parents, there were businesses, banks that wouldn't do business with us, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's really a difficult time. But, yeah, that's why I always have a certain empathy for the underdog, for those who are trying to, be created equal, so to speak. It goes back to a point you were making about that one clause in the Declaration that was bothering you. It's what I brought up earlier that, when Jefferson said all men are created equal, he was not talking about African American slaves. He was not talking about women. He was not talking about Native Americans. He was talking about white Christian landowners. Those were the people that really were the only people that truly had equality in the new nation that they were trying to create.
Mm-hmm. Doris, any take on these matters?
I don't know what he was thinking, Jefferson, because I wasn't there. all I know is that without all the people helping for slavery, the free slaves, it would not have worked. Even with the underground movement, there was a lot of white people who helped slaves to travel up north. And I know that I look beyond the movement, whereas the woman called Moses, the lady called Moses, she, if a black person came to be free with her, if they wanted to go back to their slave owner, she would kill them because he would go tell them where she was. So the struggle for freedom of the people has always been there because as a person with a heart always does what's right. That's it. But okay. Jefferson, I don't know about him.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Yeah, I have an adjustment to make in what I said previously based on Alan's thoughts that hit me and put things into place. And that is going back to the Romans where Latin was somewhat prevalent in those days. And it carried over even into our language today. He mentioned our legal system. Latin is here to stay whether we speak it or not. However, when I said there was Caucasian white people, and if you weren't Caucasian white, you were a savage. Didn't matter where you came from, what country or anything, it was declared by the color of your skin. You were a savage because you weren't Caucasian. However, the Romans did make one little distinction that may be of interest to the Judaic world, and that is they created a subset of the Caucasians. They created Jews. In other words, with respect, they put them in a subcategory. Oh, no, they're Jews. In other words, they say they may look like us, but they're really Jews. So that distinction has stuck ever since, even though we say, if you're not white, Caucasian, you're a savage. But that was the terminology that was used in the olden days. We've since tried to refine it and try to tell people, let's emphasize what we have in common and not our differences.
True. And that this is one of the something I really didn't mention yet in today's program, which I might as well mention right now, because this is one of the mission statements of our program, is to remind every human being that, in fact, they have been blessed with a divine image. It has nothing to do with what culture you're from, what your faith is, or what you might want to call your religion, what is your economic status, what is your political status, what is your sex, what is your favorite food. To me, the glue of to bring together human consciousness, again, we're not going to agree on everything. And even among Jews, we have disagreements and perceptions of what should be the law and what should be the conduct, what should be the, what we call the minhag, how to do things in the most beautiful way, hopefully in a peaceful and pleasant manner. But if we can, to me, that is part of the solution, is to remind people. And people might be brushed back and say, well, you're getting too religious or too secular. Well, let's remember, blessed souls, that way back where it says in Genesis, I think it's 1:27, that a human being was made in God's image, there was no religion back then. There was no faith back then. I mean, people, when Rabbi Manus Friedman mentions, when God spoke to Adam and Eve and to the early human beings that you read about in the first book of the Torah, that it wasn't so much they needed faith, because if God is speaking to you, you're not having a faith-based experience. You're having an actual experience of communication with Creator. So therefore, here we now, thousands and thousands of years later, and as we struggle to have this relationship with the Creator, part and parcel of our relationship is how do we conduct ourselves with other human beings. And there's been a lot of mistakes in the human family experience, and there's been some triumphs. The very fact that this country, despite its rough beginnings, still was able by, people went to war and people died for the idea of the slave trade coming to an end. However, then came the Jim Crow laws, unfortunately. And then you know, the problems that we had in the 30s and the 40s up until now, and the assassinations of all these visionary African-American leaders. It's a big problem. But, however, it's still a lot better than, say, the caste systems that are in Asia and the, unfortunately, this caliphate, which has proclaimed itself to the world. They're willing to burn and destroy everything in the name of Allah, which, by the way, Allah is actually considered by us a name that we cannot erase because it is a name that has been given respect and accord by the Arabic Islamic peoples. So, again, we have not come to any final conclusion, at least I have. I have not come to a final conclusion about what the Declaration of Independence ultimately is in the scheme of human history. Other than that, it can serve as a catalyst for us to learn for what is worth standing up to and what is worth rectifying to hopefully upgrade the human film experience to prepare the world for the universal redemption. So I'll turn to now Alan, Dennis, and Doris with their final commentary, and then we're going to segue out with our flagship ending music by Brother David Dome. Alan, can you please respond?
Well, one of the things I bring out in the book is that the Noahide Law is not based on religion. The Noahide Law is a moral and legal code. Something that needs to be adopted into every non-Jewish society, and we have to appeal to the people. And you know, this was something that was brought out in the Declaration of Independence. If your government is unjust and making unjust laws, doing things like, you know, you mentioned the Jim Crow laws. You know, after the slaves were freed, you know, we went through this horrible civil war. Our legal system of the South still enacted these laws to persecute African Americans. To me, the legal system should be the focus of what it is we're needing to change, because the Noahide Law is at its core a moral and legal system. You can't separate the two.
So, and even in Israelite society proper, our society doesn't change unless people adhere to the law. Dennis, your take on these matters.
What is real is what you believe in. And I only have a couple of words for Alan. Keep on writing.
And keep on coming on the show. Keep on coming on the show, Alan. Dennis and Doris, please, you're also, you know, I've already announced you as a co-host, which means that you're welcome to come back anytime when you're aware of the fact we're doing a program. Any concluding remarks, perceptions you want to share with our blessed living live audience and those who will hear your blessed voice on the archive version?
We're all one in God, and that we should, the two laws is that we should love God above all things and love our brother as ourselves. And that is one of the two commandments, that we love our brother as ourselves. And that's it. Thank you.
Beautiful. Doris, thank you. Doris, thank you very much for calling in from Houston, Texas. Alan from Southern Florida, and from New York, Dennis Ryan, and this is Dunzis Goodman, your local cyberspace Torah activist here from broadcasting live from Kesset Crown Heights, reminding everyone, no matter who we are, eventually we'll have to face the truth. That's the name of our flagship ending song by Brother David Dome, who will take us back home to realize our divine images, help us give up the scrimmage. Our Tzelem Elohim is no dream. Remember, but those, you've got to be good. Why? Because you have the power, and it's in your DNA, because Ateva Tov Lehetiv is the nature of the good to do good. The Almighty Creator imbued you with this ability, and I know it's hard. I struggle with it too, but we can do good like we know we should. But maybe if we meditate on these words of face the truth, we'll be a little more empowered to do what's right, to prepare the world to become a proper abode for the restoration of the human family experience. Hopefully in a way of a havachad, one love, goral achad, one destiny, l'kulano for all of us, b'darkei shalom, darkei nom, in a peaceful and pleasant way, l'hamshik, to be continued, b'ez Hashem yisprek, to be continued with the help of the Most High. Take care, everyone. And happy 4th of July.
Yay!
When did you stop thinking for yourself? Who switched you off? Where had you gone? You tell fighting for the sort of fall. Provokes the lips you think is happiness. Turn it off. Turn it off. You've been a fool.